The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This week we're featuring Emma Donoghue's Booker Prize shortlisted novel, Room, about a mother and her small son who are imprisoned in a room for more than 5 years. It was published soon after the Joseph Fritzl story broke of a mother kept hostage with her children in Austria. So host John Mullen asked Emma if she thought anybody had read the book not knowing what it was likely to be about.
When I first read it, I suppose I already knew stuff.
That's the paradox of publicity, isn't it?
Yes.
Writers would prefer if readers were just tapped on the shoulder in the street and told, read this from the first page, don't even look at the cover. But in order to sell the books to the readers, we have to tell them a certain amount. But we write all our books wishing the reader didn't know.
Because there would be an extraordinary effect of kind of dizziness and disorientation if one was to read it.
But you know, some readers do, not my friends and family, but I've had readers write to me and say, I didn't know a thing about your book, I didn't read the blurb, I didn't see any of the interviews. And I read the book, and for the first 20 pages, I was convinced that mother was mad, barking mad. She never let the boy go out. So it is possible to read a book innocently, as it were. And I almost wish everyone read books that way.
And did you find that people talked about the book who hadn't yet read it, who maybe were going to read it or weren't going to read it, but who already had views about it before they started the first page?
I didn't care. I mean, writing is such a private, obsessive, really borderline mentally ill activity. You know, you get utterly preoccupied with this subject and this story, and you're in your own little world with it. So every now and then you might think, ooh, readers might hate this bit, but then you say, who cares? And you just go back to it. It's just your little personal love affair. And you feel you're writing for the ideal reader, the one out there who's going to, you know, read it in a concentrated way and bring all their mind and their heart to it. So you don't worry about actual readers or actual critics. You're alone with the book. It's lovely.
But did you have that feeling when you got the idea, as it were, that it was a hideous premise?
Well, to me, I quickly sort of leapt past the hideousness of it and thought, how interesting that would be, you know? So I thought a child like that, a child raised in a locked room, would have an interesting view of the world. So I made that leap. But whenever I was attempting to describe my novel to somebody, I'd say, oh yeah, I've just sold a novel, it's about, and I would describe it, and then I'd think, that sounds disgusting. But I also wanted it to be completely convincing, because if you're going to put your readers through the anxiety and tension of making them worry for this 5-year-old boy and will he get out safe, then it's got to be a real room, you know, that it can't be just a mental exercise. So I didn't want it to read like a parable. I wanted it to read like a real room, and if it worked in other ways as well and had other symbolism, then great, but they had to believe in the room. So I listed every object in the room. It was a sort of a perfect exercise for a writer in that it was a controllable world. And I knew not only every object that my main characters had to hand, but I knew everything that was in this boy's head as well, because I knew every experience he'd ever had.
But I mean, did you also have to research, say, how they would be treated afterwards?
Videos of, I remember, say, one particular kidnapped victim, Elizabeth Smart. I remember watching a video in which, you know, she had clearly agreed beforehand with the interviewer, don't ask me for details about the rape. And yet the video was like, oh, just to help all those other victims out there, could you tell us a bit about... And also message boards in which lots of people were writing in to say what they felt about Elizabeth Fritzl. And they were clearly just projecting their fantasies of good and evil onto this woman they didn't know.
Even though I knew there was an escape, and the logical person in me knew that as the escape happens, the actual process of the escape happens slightly before the halfway mark, that probably from the reviews I have read, it's going to be successful. And yet still, you get completely caught up in the sort of terror of whether
I think
it's
a lot
going
of readers were afraid that I would follow in that tradition of the woman has to die so the boy or man will live.
Yes.
I mean, from, you know, think of films like Betty Blue, there's a strong tradition of, oh, somebody's got to die, it'll be the mother.
Yes.
So I think people were actually more afraid for Ma at many points in the narrative.
And were you very conscious of other narrative decisions? So, for instance, okay, you must have... we think about the family. She's got a family... And
well, my research very quickly told me the parents will probably have split up. I mean, the rate of marriage breakdown after
so that's
your
a kind
daughter
of empirical
goes missing.
Thing. That wasn't her.
But I thought it was a good for fiction as well, because it'll be more interesting if the family she comes back to is not the same as the family she left behind.
Yes.
You know, these reunion scenes are so fakey, you know, in Hello Magazine, you know, happy kidnapped victim reunited with her loving family. And you're thinking, oh, I wish I was a fly on that wall. You just know there will be painful, painful changes because of the years that they have got on with their lives without her. So I thought, ooh, I'll give her a brother and he's got married.
Yes.
You know, so there's been all this family getting on with their lives without her. She's going to feel so irritated by this. And the parents will have split up. So I would say that was empirical, but also literary. I thought
I guess it enables you in the manipulative novelist mode to make the parents react in very different ways, because the father is...
The poor father just can't cope with this little spawn of rape. Like, I'm expected to be nice to this child, this proof that my daughter was violated.
Yes.
So I wanted to show that the human range of reactions to a case like Ma's. But above all, I wanted to make one nice man for Jack, and I wanted him to be the step-grandfather. I didn't want him to be the expected man. And so not a boyfriend for Ma and not the biological grandfather. But I wanted him to be this complete stranger, really. So to provide one man with whom Jack would have a kind of a natural, easy rapport. And I thought it'll be great if this is some new member of the family who Ma doesn't even know, you know? Because in a way, I wanted to show that Jack is going to get on with embracing the world, whether Ma's with him or not. You know, that's the ruthlessness of children. They survive.
One obvious one is the mother's attempted suicide. Well, can I just ask you why you made that decision? I mean, apart from the fact that it's perfectly plausible somebody could...
Again, it was empirical and literary. I can't remember which came first. It could be that I thought, I want Jack to start adapting to the world and growing up and coping without Ma. So how can I separate him from her for a while? So that was a cold-blooded, as it were, literary decision. Like, he's going to start growing up faster if I separate him. But then it seemed from everything I read empirically that people often fall apart after they get out of solitary, for instance. And instead of having a breakdown while they're in solitary in prison, they'll get out, they'll be back in the general population, and then they crack up. I think one reason that decision bothers so many readers is that... my commitment to telling the story from Jack's point of view meant that it had to come as a surprise to the reader because it comes as a surprise to Jack. So they didn't see it coming because Jack is the point of view there. And I think the effect there was that they were outraged by it because they didn't see the hints. So I think that might be a moment where the telling of the story from Jack's point of view had a sort of a built-in weakness that suddenly Ma's behavior was going to seem inexplicable to them.
And finally, the actual end.
You know, I never thought of any other ending but that.
That was always there.
I always knew a book in two halves and it's got to end with them going back. Yeah, and saying goodbye to the place and have the place be, you know, diminished and faded.
Lots of people have noticed that for the narrator, it seems that this appalling confinement is the happiest scenario imaginable for a small child, just locked up all the time with only their mother.
Yeah, my son was 4 when I got the idea for the book, and I thought, he'd like that. He'd like to have me trapped here with him, you know. And my mother, who had 8 of us, she used to describe a moment where she would try and use a public toilet. You know, she'd go in the cubicle and lock the door, and then she'd see the little hands coming under. And she would get this impulse to stamp on them. She never stamped on our hands. But I understand and I honor that impulse. And, you know, a lot of the fathers and mothers of our generation were doing very intensive parenting. There's an awful lot of cuddles and reading them stories. And perhaps, you know, because we work during the day, there's a lot of, oh, let's have quality time for a few hours. So we often have these very intense intimacies with our children, but every now and then you get this kind of surge of, get me out of here. And I'm sure the child too gets a surge of, get me out of here. You know, any such intimacy, like romantic love, I think parental child love has those moments of claustrophobia.
He is a kind of sometimes disturbingly cheerful narrator. actually.
Yes, he can sound a little bit sinister, can't he?
Well,
it's as if babyhood hasn't had to end for him. You know, he's never had to be weaned because, you know, weaning is what you do when you want to sort of enter the social world and say to your child, take a bottle instead, I'm going out. But he's never had to do that. I didn't try and make this sort of representative of kidnapping situations at all. In a way, it was a test case. I was saying to myself, what if you had, you know, enough to eat and vitamins and you were healthy and your mother was making it as perfect as she could, but you still don't have the world? How much is the world worth to a child? How much is the world needed by a child compared with, you know, the bliss of the bond with one close parent? So it was kind of, I was sort of setting it up as a test situation. I think my originality has been really overstated. There's a strong tradition of child's voice fiction. I felt I was one humble contributor. So sometimes people go on as if, oh, I invented this brand new voice. I mean, I grew up on things like Roddy Doyle's novel, Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha, which won the Booker when I was a teenager. And that's got this wonderful voice of, I think it's a 10-year-old. So there are all sorts of books with a great child's voice. Something as old as Alice in Wonderland has got whole sections where Alice talks in a very convincing childlike voice. So it's a literary tradition.
And what about that very striking thing which is there in the title of the novel? The words for objects become their names.
Yeah,
there's room
for the main objects, there's table. Yeah, I mean, if there's five forks, they are the forks, but there's one spoon with a melted handle and that becomes Melted-y Spoon. I just noticed from my children and other children that they personalise everything. They have that tendency to make friends of things. And I thought, Jack's social impulses have to have some outlet. So he will make friends of things and he will, as it were, see spirits in things. I remember at one point thinking of him and Ma as like a sort of island culture. I thought, I don't want to see them just as kind of weird cut-off victims. I want to imagine them like Crusoe and Friday. You know, they've got this little island and Ma's bringing a certain amount of Western culture into it, but it's going to start to hybridize. So as it were, the furniture starts to kind of come to life a bit. But Jack's English is not actually all that odd. I mean, I just used a little bit of 5-year-old grammar from listening to my children.
So you did do that?
I followed my son around and I wrote down all the grammar mistakes he made. And there were about 20 different categories of mistakes. Yes. And I thought, oh God, I can't be fully realistic here because, you know, dialogue in fiction is not the same as in real life. So if I actually use all these mistakes, he's going to sound as if he's damaged mentally. You know? So I thought I'll pick just a few which are fairly transparent.
The effect that I found most vivid and most upsetting, I suppose, was what you could divine from the exchanges between Ma and Old Nick. That, of course, she was imprisoned and she was, you would say, raped regularly. But it kind of also wasn't quite like that. It was, but she had developed a ghastly modus vivendi. Of course she had.
I agree. Some of the creepiest lines in the book are when she's saying, oh, come to bed.
Yeah, come to bed. That is the creepiest bit in the whole book.
The book deliberately doesn't focus on Old Nick because our culture is obsessed with the figure of the psychopath who captures women. I mean, really, in a few hundred years, they will look back and they'll say, Was that society absolutely full of psychopaths burying girls in their garden? Because, I mean, it is what we're obsessed by, not just in films, but in books. So I didn't want to grant Old Nick that much interest. But I did want to, in a way, punish him already by the time the novel begins by showing how boring this particular sex dungeon has become to him. It's become domestic. He's having to take out the rubbish and remember to buy the groceries. I wanted to make it the worst kind of marriage.
Yes.
Like, you thought you were getting a sexy situation. God, it's become a grind. You know, the cork is wearing away by the grouting of the bath. You know, there's the kid. You know, he doesn't even have some happy relationship with the kid. The kid is nothing but, you know, a further hungry mouth to him. And, you know, the boring, nagging wife, you know. So, yeah, I wanted to, in a way, take all the sexiness out of the situation by setting it up like that. I suppose one reason I gave him TV was that when he comes out into the world, I wanted Jack to profoundly misunderstand things, but not just because he's never heard of them. I didn't want him to be like, what is that thing? And her mom to be saying, it's a car. You know, I wanted to be more like, oh, yeah, I know cars. I don't know cars because this thing is coming at me and I'm afraid it's going to knock me down. So I wanted to explore the difference between that kind of casual visual familiarity and actual full understanding of what the world is like, you know, to touch and feel.
Almost the first people he encounters are the police. And he kind of knows about the police. He's kind of interested in the police. He's seen the police. And he knows there's good police and bad police. He's kind of seen corrupt police on the television. You know, it's a kind of strange encounter of what he does not know, yet he thinks he recognises.
Or dogs. You think he knows dogs, but he only knows dogs on the screen. He doesn't know dogs that bite, you know.
Yes.
So I remember early on deciding, okay, he's going to find a dog. Children always say they want a pet. My own nag me for pets all the time, and the dog's going to bite him, you know.
And the guy, the owner, says, Raja's very sorry. And he says he didn't look sorry. Okay, so that, I mean, the escape is brilliantly and properly, excitingly done, in a sense. And then you're halfway through the novel, and you've got the second half. And it strikes me that must have been a much tougher half, in a way, to write, because you have all these other voices. Suddenly.
Yes, and you've more options about where they go, what's going to happen to them. You know, the world is more diffuse. Yeah, and I knew a lot of readers preferred the first half, and I knew they probably would. But I was just really interested in what was going to happen in the second half, because to get back to this thing about Room being an extreme version of the ordinary parental story, I thought, you know, only in the second half will Ma have to really let Jack start to grow up. You know, those moments when a child progresses faster than you do, and the bond will be tested. And so I thought it'll be like a coming-of-age novel, but in miniature. You know, in a matter of weeks, Jack's going to go from really a state of newbornness to a stage of, you know, I'm going off to have fun in the park with my uncle. So to me, the real interest of the novel was in that move into the second half. Whereas I think the readers who wanted it to be just an exciting story about a little boy in danger, they would have preferred it to end at the moment of escape. But to me, that would have been facile to end with, oh, we're out, we're in America, all our problems are at an end. That's another decision I sweated over, was where to set it. Well, I didn't want Europe, right, because the Fritzl case was Austria. So I thought I'll set it in America and above ground, not below ground. So again, separate from the Fritzls. And then, of course, after I wrote the novel, J.C. Dugard was discovered in a shed in California. So I thought, okay, you clearly can't get away from real cases. But no, one reason I set it in America was that when they get rescued, I wanted the rescuers to think, oh, lucky them. Look, they're now in America. Everything's fine. And then, of course, everything isn't fine. So I wanted a society that's very smug about being the answer to every immigrant's dreams. You know, like, you're here now. Yeah. You can relax. Yeah. You know, this is the modern world at its best. And also, I knew the publicity would be particularly cruel in the second half of the novel. And even though publicity is everywhere now, I think that particular style of publicity was invented in America. My senses say the Screen magazine about film stars in the 1920s, the idea of the probing interview. I think that, you know, particular style of tell us more about your pain. I thought, oh, should it be America or Canada where I live? And then I thought, no, I want them to be worried about their medical bills, set it in America. Because one reason she goes ahead and does that ill-advised television interview is to make money for the bills.
For me, one of the most memorable passages in the second half of the novel was when they go into the shopping mall.
A shopping mall, which is a nightmare to most of
us. Which is a nightmare. And that was a kind of grotesque exaggeration of what anybody with small children has once experienced, you know.
And the unrealness of a shopping mall, you know, the kind of music coming from the walls and the plant that turns out to be plastic, you know, and the peculiar conventions like throwing money in fountains. And, you know, in a way, our children are all aliens, you know. You know, probably my children were two when they were discovering a shopping mall and the oddity of it, or being frightened by the automatic flush. But they had all these experiences, so whether they have them at two or all at once, like Jack at five, it's the same thing. We have to teach our children the totally arbitrary social rules. I remember when I moved to Canada, they give all immigrants a kind of a book from the government that tells you the rules of the society. And it actually spelled out, you know, in a shopping mall, you have to pay for things as you leave each individual shop element, even if there's no door. But in a supermarket, it's all one shop, so you pay at the end. And I thought, wow, if you didn't know that, you could so easily get arrested for shoplifting, you know.
So there's people talking about social reintegration and cognitive distortion. But it's still Jack who has to give us this stuff.
Yeah, now he doesn't give you entire paragraphs of therapy speak, and he doesn't explain to you what it's about. He's given you, in a way, the tiny little bits that he's picked up on the kind of radio. And in a way, I was trying to show that the new vocabulary is part of the overload to his senses. Suddenly, lots of new words, lots of new sensory experiences. So I talked a lot, for instance, to a friend who's an occupational therapist with small kids, and she was saying, you know, he would effectively be put into a state of you know, sensory shock, because he won't know where sounds are coming from. He won't know how to listen to five people talking at once. So in a way, showing the kind of mosaic of the world, it wasn't just about giving information to the reader, it was also partly about showing Jack besieged by novelty. Yeah. I mean, a lot of readers do feel a loss in the second half. A lot of readers find themselves nostalgic for the terrible situation in which Ma was living. And in a way, I wanted them to find themselves, you know, like Jack, thinking, but it was so cozy back then. Yeah. It was just us, you know. And then I wanted them to go, ah, I'm being nostalgic for a situation of a locked door.
My last question, really, because I must hand it over. But I found myself thinking, he's going to say at some stage, do you wish we hadn't escaped? And sure enough, on page 392 of 400, he does ask that question, and it did, that felt like a kind of absolutely inescapable sort of narrative turn or psychological turn near the end of the novel. Well, a good place to me to stop spouting and ask everybody here. We've got a travelling mic or two, I think.
I was just curious, how did you decide on the dimensions of the room?
That's a great question. Yes. Nobody's ever asked me that before. You know, we all grew up on a digital system, meaning numbers divisible by 10. So I thought 10 feet. And then I thought, oh, I have to allow a foot for, soundproofing and insulation and padding. So that means outer dimensions 11 by 11, inner dimensions 10 by 10. I found a square somehow satisfying, more than a rectangle. And that seemed a kind of a credible amount of space that a kidnapper might decide to give his victim when buying a shed. So, you know, now when I go by those outdoor garden stores that sell sheds, you know, I shudder whenever I see the sheds. I thought he wouldn't have planned on the child. So he'd have been thinking of it as just, you know, a room for one person. And I didn't want it to be like such a tiny little cell that they're literally elbowing each other out of the way. So I was trying to think of a space that would be, you know, where a child would feel this is fine and where the mother would feel this is intolerable. But I also wanted to kind of play with the proportions of it, like to have Jack think of it as a space that can easily morph, like all we have to do is put the table on the bed and then we can run around. Whereas to the mother, these are all, you know, hideous devices, because really, who wants to have to put their table on their bed every time they go for a walk?
My question was, it seemed to me not only a book about using kind of media sensational stories about kidnapping, but a book about books. I mean, the interaction with the fairy tales, with the voice of Portrait of the Artist as a young man.
Glad you got that bit.
I don't know whether I did or not, but I wondered, as a novelist, to what extent, I understand you studied literature in Dublin, I went to UCD myself, what a literary education or degree has affected your approach to writing a work like this?
It absolutely is a book about books. And it's funny because I often meet readers who take it as a very straightforward study, like, oh, cute little boy in danger. And I think, well, actually, it's totally elusive, but I'm glad none of that bothered you, you know? So I suppose the way I put the allusions in was, I thought, well, anyone who's read Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man will probably notice I'm, you know, copying an entire line from it. You know, they'll get that, but I don't want the reader who hasn't read Joyce to go, what's this funny bit here? So I tried to put the allusions in a way that wouldn't bother anybody. Again, there's a line where Jack effectively quotes Genesis. There's one where he quotes the line from St. Paul about, you know, I see through a mirror darkly. So I had great fun throwing in echoes of books that he hasn't read, because I think it's quite possible for one person like Ma to pass on a huge amount of our culture through her own voice. For instance, the Coen brothers won an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for adapting The Odyssey into O Brother, Where Art Thou? And they were most amused because they never read The Odyssey. But you know, in a way, you don't need to have read The Odyssey. I've been told that this book owes a lot to Faulkner, and I'm going, great, I never actually read him, but perhaps it has been transmitted somehow. So culture leaks. And so I was really interested in how you could take a room and you could see that as a space with no culture in it, but through what Ma brings in her head. And she's not even that old or experienced or well-read, but through what she brings in, the song lyrics, the, you know, whether they be Kylie Minogue or folk songs or fairy tales, she's bringing a lot with her. So again, they're kind of like an island culture. There's a lot that she's carried. There's a lot of cultural baggage, literally. And I was very cruel in only giving them a total of 10 books.
Oh, yeah, you are. I'm looking at the list of what she has.
Her list is particularly
awful. The Shack. What is The Shack?
I've never read The Shack.
What is it?
But a friend of mine winced her way through it. Right. It's a little kind of parable about somebody in a shack who meets God.
Okay. Twilight.
Haven't read it, but it's vampires, yeah.
The Guardian.
That one, I believe, is a Nicholas Sparks. Again, wildly popular. I was trying to pick books that would have been available.
Bittersweet Love.
That's a randomly chosen romance. It is a real romance.
And The Coup de Grâce. The Da Vinci Code.
I felt a comfort and a warmth with the two of them in the room. And then I felt a profound sadness, actually, when they escaped and the struggles that they were facing and they ended up facing. I just wondered how you felt emotionally writing that.
Good question. I think what makes writers truly sad is not the same as what makes readers sad, in that when we have to put our characters through miserable things, often we're going, yes, that scene works. So we are cruel, you know. So yes, there were moments in the second half where I felt sad because Jack was sad, but I was feeling very quietly satisfied too. And again, in the first half, you know, when I was writing cruel moments, like when Ma has to say to the rapist, oh, come to bed, you know, that's very satisfying to a writer. So all I can say is we get pleasure from putting our characters through misery, so long as it feels right, you know, we get pleasure from choosing the right word. And the odd thing about the process of Room and what it did to me emotionally was that the research was truly horrendous. And I'm very zealous in my research. So even though I knew Room would be a kind of a best case scenario, I still needed to read about all forms of child abuse and child neglect. And I was trying to sort of find what kids can survive and what they can't. So I read a lot about kids raised, you know, locked away in hen houses and so on. A lot of it I wish I hadn't. It was terrifying.
But I just wondered if you've had any reactions from people who have suffered child abuse or been abducted, and kind of what their reactions were to the book, if they felt that it in any way reflected their experience, or maybe they were angry or disgusted. I don't know.
I don't think people who have survived kidnappings pick up novels like Room to read. I think their friends probably warn them off it. So no, I haven't heard from people who've experienced kidnappings. However, I've heard a lot from readers with whom the story strikes sparks because either they were in a violent marriage or in a violent family or in a religious cult, or sometimes just that they were raised in a very poor and limited situation where they perceived their childhood to be like Jack's. So not literally like Jack's, but they'll write to me and say, it was like that, we were in one room, times were hard, you know, we never saw anybody. So people connect with this story in all sorts of ways. And the most moving one was a woman wrote to me and said that she was in this violent marriage, and then she took the kids and left, but she said she didn't leave until the kids were a certain age. And she said the bit that distressed her in the book was when Jack, you know, gets the rug back from the police and he wants to use the rug. He finds the rug precious and the mother is just repelled by the rug. And she said, with my kids, it's like that. They have memories of their childhood that are precious to them because it was their childhood. And to me, I wish I could erase the whole thing, but I have to accept that for them, it's like that rug. You know, we have to live with the rug. So it's taught me that readers connect with a book story in all sorts of ways, whether literal or not. An awful lot of men write to me about this book and talk about their feelings for their sons and grandchildren. So, you know, you can never predict what a reader is going to connect with in your story. I love that. It's as if every reader reads a different book. The book doesn't really happen until each of you cracks it open.
But could you talk a little bit about at what point you fixed the title and anything you could, any insights about like the cover for the book? Because I imagine that would have been a challenge to come up with the way it looked and the way it was packaged.
Sure. The title I had on day one, I got the idea for this book all at once while I was driving, and I'm a really bad, nervous driver, and I was driving myself to a reading. So driving along a highway in Canada, and I think I'd heard about the Fritzl case a couple of days before, and literally as I drove, I started to think, oh, there's a, you know, if you took a child like that, there'd be a novel. There'd be a novel there. There'd be a story to tell. I couldn't pull over because it's the highway and you're not allowed to stop on the highway. So I was driving along in this fugue state. But when I finally got to my location and started making basic notes on a soiled, dirty napkin from the glove compartment, I knew it would be called Room. The escape would be in the middle. The final scene would be them going back to Room. You know, all the major elements came to me and I never questioned them. I never questioned anyone else narrating any of it. I always knew that the story would stop where it did, and you know, I was really lucky with this book that so much of it fell into my lap. Covers are a different business. I remember squabbling with Picador about this cover because I didn't want to show Jack. I always think it's better not to show the main character, so they have him be blurry, but to me he looked a bit like a burn victim, you know? So we haggled a lot over that. I liked the little house.
Was the hardback
had just the little house, yes. You see. I thought that was a much more powerful image with the little window drawn on. What publishers always say is with the paperback, you need photographs. You know, it's received wisdom that people buy paperbacks in less literary settings like, you know, airports and so on, and that they need a photograph to create that kind of emotive link, you know. But I'd prefer it without the little boy, frankly.
I find the room is very, very different from some of the other stuff you've written. Do you feel like it has a link to some of your other books? And if it's passed the baton on to anything you'll write in the future, how it's impacted it?
I think there's two kinds of writers, like two kinds of actors. There's the, you know, the stars, the Robert De Niro, Cormac McCarthy. Okay, you know Robert De Niro, in whatever he's in, he's always Robert De Niro. Cormac McCarthy is always Cormac McCarthy. And they have the real glamour. You know, they're always themselves. And they might get a bit repetitious at times. You can even make fun of them, perhaps, but they have their set style. And then there are the actors like Daniel Day-Lewis, where you suddenly think, I've seen him in four different films, and he was unrecognizable. And so I try and be that kind of writer, the one where quite often I'll meet somebody who's read three of my books, and they don't realize they were all by me. And I think, great, because it's not about me. You know, I'm not trying to be a cult figure here. I'm not even trying to have a famous distinctive style. I want people to remember the characters and the book and the story. And so I always try and shape my style to what the story seems to require. So, for instance, some of my books have like no sex in them at all. I wanted room to really not have sex in it at all. But say my most recent book, Frog Music, has lots of sex because it's narrated by a prostitute who likes sex. So to me, I don't try and approach the book with my style already in place. I'm really trying to serve the story. I would say Room has some things in common with my historical fiction, in that historical fiction, what you do is you try and conjure up a world for your readers through your point of view character, and you know, without explicitly being a tour guide, you try and welcome your readers into this strange little world to them. And so whether you're writing about 18th century London or a locked shed, it's the same thing. It's sort of like, here's my world, come on in.
So thank you for the question, and thank you to Emma. You're not supposed to clap.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.